Welcome to Quinn's Empowerment Hour on the BBS Radio Network, hosted by Quinn Lay Erickson, psychotherapist, life coach, and inspirational speaker. Quinn's experience as a blind woman, a boat person from Vietnam, and a refugee has driven her to realize her dream to help you to become the best that you can be. So join Quinn every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time, for an hour of insight and inspiration for your heart, your spirit, and your soul. Hello, this is Quinn's Empowerment Hour with Quinn Lay Erickson. Thank you for joining me tonight. So tonight I'm very pleased to be able to invite a guest onto the show. Her name is Jill Corey. And Jill Corey is an author, she's a speaker, as well as a policy analyst. She has been supporting women experiencing abuse and violence in their relationships for the last 30 years. Jill has co-authored a very powerful book called When Love Hurts, A Woman's Guide to Understanding Abuse in Their Relationships. And so I will talk to Jill about what can women do when they find themselves in an abusive relationship, and also how can professionals best support these women. So without any further ado, here is Jill Corey. So thanks, Jill, for coming onto my show. I really appreciate having you here today.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
What might be some of the signs for women to recognize that they are in an abusive relationship? Because it may start out sort of probably, I would imagine, gradually, right?
As you say, it starts out slowly.
Yeah.
As a society, we don't name a lot of abusive behaviors as abuse. So women come to accept a certain level of control or oppression, and it's compensated by that complex dynamic of positive behaviors on the part of an abusive partner, and then the escalating abuse.
You know, because a lot of the behaviors in the beginning, like you said, not so obvious, or perhaps even they grew up in families where some of those behaviors may have been the norms. So what might be some of those behaviors that women can start to name that as abusive?
Mm-hmm. And again, I think some women have grown up with abuse, but many women have grown up with the idea that men have are more privileged and entitled in our society. And so when that is demonstrated in the relationship, it's not necessarily abnormal for women. So, for example, when a man tells a lie about where he's been early on in a relationship, a woman might feel quite upset about that. Mm-hmm. But she's more likely to ask herself, what have I done that he could have told me that, than to have high expectations of him being honest. So I think those dynamics are often very subtle like that, you know, where he says he's going to do something and he doesn't do it, and she may feel disappointed, and then he turns the tables on her and says, well, your expectations are too high of me. And right from the early days of the relationship, an abusive man kind of creates the environment under which women then start to feel like she's doing something wrong and needs to correct her own behavior. Yeah. It's sometimes quite subtle, but it's very effective. So that women over time stop asking what's wrong, why is he doing this, and starts thinking about what's wrong with me and I need to change and fix myself. So when I'm talking to women, we don't necessarily see the early signs until they're well into the relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because, again, the escalation of more negative and abusive behaviors is in contrast to what we would call the honeymoon, which is where he's loving and charming and romantic and makes promises for the future, and she sees what she would say is kind of positive and respectful behavior. And then she experiences a change in his mood, or he becomes absent or threatening or sarcastic or mean, maybe, you know, sometimes in public, sometimes not, maybe a bit threatening. And especially at the beginning when that first happens, it takes women by such surprise that they see it as an abnormality in the relationship rather than part of his behavior. So none of us leave a relationship the first time there's conflict or something that we're uncomfortable with. So it's not unusual for a woman who ultimately sees that he's abusive to stay. I think I don't know very many people who turn away from a relationship at the first sign of something negative, particularly because that honeymoon is so intense and yes. so hopeful that it doesn't give women enough evidence to feel like there's a reason to leave. It doesn't make, she's uncomfortable with it. And I've never met a woman who accepts that behavior, but it's in the larger context of this honeymoon behavior. And it's very confusing, very hard for women to make sense of that.
For a woman in an abusive relationship, have you noticed what might be some protective factors that help them to be able to leave such relationships?
Well, I think the first thing, I'll speak from two places. One is mm-hmm. when I support a woman to name her experience as abuse, that is sometimes the beginning of a journey to make different decisions about the relationship. But leaving is a very challenging idea, and it's part of what the book challenges both society and women to think differently about the problem than her leaving. The problem is that he's abusive, mm-hmm. and often women are only left with two choices. One is to leave and be financially precarious, as well as perhaps and potentially having to share custody of children, so not being able to be present to supervise the safety of their children or protect their children. So the leaving discourse is quite problematic.
Yes. Yeah.
Because we simply don't have the right resources in place for many women to leave. We have emergency responses in women's shelters, mm-hmm. but we do not necessarily, often do not have the financial resources, appropriate, safe and secure housing for women. Women have virtually no access any longer to legal assistance, so they don't have access to justice. So there are many, many barriers that prevent women from leaving, besides the relationship itself and those dynamics, which can be so overwhelming, confusing, and dangerous for women.
Mm-hmm. So quite torn, right? And then especially if they have children or if they have not been working outside the home.
Right, right. And often, I mean, many women do work, but often women are prevented from working outside the home as a way of keeping her isolated and keeping control over her and really trapping her in the relationship. But even for women that work, they may or may not have access to their own economic means. He may be drinking or gambling, or he may just control all the money and she doesn't have any access to it without fear of being interrogated and under constant threat of how she spent money. So women are quite vulnerable both within the relationship, but also after they leave the relationship because mm-hmm. the resources mm-hmm. aren't there. So I think we may not be able to stop men from being abusive, but we can most certainly do a much better job of ensuring that women have access to enough money to provide a safe environment for themselves and their children and access to legal support.
So when a woman is in an abusive relationship, can you share with us what might be some of the feelings and experiences that they go through on a regular basis?
Right.
So for the women who are listening, you know, it's a way to validate their feelings and experiences.
Yes. So for one thing, I think we often understand the cycle of abuse in terms of how men act. Mm-hmm. But my co-author and I, Karen, and I really see is how important it is for women to be able to talk about what it's like for them to be kind of pushed through this cycle from the honeymoon mm-hmm. to the tension to the escalation of behavior. And I just want to be really clear that when we're talking about violence against women or woman abuse, we're not talking about only physical abuse. We're talking about emotional abuse, verbal abuse, financial, sexual abuse, psychological abuse, spiritual and social abuse. So it runs along a continuum, and all of them have an impact on women. Mm-hmm. So in the honeymoon cycle, for example, when it looks like he's kind of come back to the relationship and he's more respectful or involved with the children, she may feel like, oh, here we go again. Now I have to act like everything's okay when it doesn't feel okay. He might be more attentive in the family, but she might just want to go in to her bedroom and close the door. But she is afraid to do that because she's afraid that it will escalate again. She feels maybe skeptical at the same time as relieved. She may be confused, or she may see it really clearly but not know what to do about it. She may have lots of physical ailments like migraines and stomach problems. And I've worked with women who've had miscarriages, forced either, you know, from an assault or forced abortions or forced pregnancies. So women experience a whole range of health, mental health, even substance use. Many women talk about using substances, whether they're prescription medications or alcohol or drugs, just to cope with all the feelings, just to feel like they can get through the next day. Living in that kind of fear takes its toll on women.
So they would always be in survival mode.
Absolutely, on high alert. Mm-hmm. And so again, when women come in contact with support people, it looks like women have problems, but actually what they have are all these significant effects on their mental health and their physical health and just on their coping. So they often don't look like they're doing very well, but in fact, they're pretty human responses to living under that kind of tension and fear and trying to always stay one step ahead. And women talk about walking on eggshells, never knowing when they're going to set off another explosion and not having any control over that, which is, of course, the worst of all things, is that they have no control over when it happens and how it happens. So we get this dynamic where women are always searching ways to fix themselves because their partner, sometimes their counselor, sometimes the police or a pastor will say, if you weren't so assertive, or if you had better boundaries, or if you obeyed more, or if you went to work, or if you lost weight, or if you didn't have so many children. So women are told by their abusive partners, but also from helpers, that they need to be fixed. So women get caught in this dynamic of trying to fix themselves in this kind of intense survival mode, as you say. And it really takes its toll. Women don't sleep well. They're afraid to fall asleep because things often escalate. He often escalates the abuse at night. They may feel like they have to stay awake to protect their children. So women are exhausted, overwhelmed, confused. And a lot of that just is traced back to us as a society not talking about abuse and how it impacts women.
I think often when we think of abused women, we have this image that they would look quite haggard and beaten. And so is that what you say? That's sort of not more like a myth, because a lot of people, a lot of women look quite together on
Absolutely.
The outside.
Yes. And it is part of what silences women, is that they think that being a woman who's battered or in a domestic violence, those stereotypes often are inaccurate. And then women who are actually experiencing abuse think, well, that's not really me. So I guess I'm not a woman who's experiencing abuse. Mm-hmm. And it really, again, it doesn't help women to be able to name their experience and do something about it. I think, you know, the media and some of the really high profile cases of violence against women do point to some of the major impacts, but there are hundreds of thousands of women walking around. I worked at a hospital for many years, and I know that about 30% of nurses have or had experienced abuse. We did a survey.
Yeah.
So it certainly isn't the stereotype, and we really try to encourage women to not see themselves as a battered woman, but as a woman who's had abuse happened to them or that they've experienced it, but it's not defining. And there is no stereotype. There isn't a way that women look.
Is there any sort of certain demographics that they're more susceptible? Or is it sort of across different socioeconomic background? And
yeah, that's a great question. Again, it's another myth, isn't it, that it can be passed to certain women. And somehow when we say certain women, we sometimes think women who don't deserve better treatment. So we might think of women who have low incomes or live in low income families. We might think about women who are immigrant women or Aboriginal women. But in fact, it cuts across all class and race and ethnicity and religion. Where some of those factors do enter in is how they're treated by the systems, by support services. So abuse can happen to any woman and does. But often systems have a lens that doesn't treat certain women very well, like women who are survival sex workers or Aboriginal women sometimes are treated very poorly in the system. And so that's really where the significant barrier comes for women. It's not so much that there's a group of women who are more likely to be abused, but there is some research showing that some groups of women are not treated as well as other women when they come in mm-hmm. contact with services.
Would you say some women can come across even angry and aggressive when they go to receive help? And so professionals, difficult for them to imagine that these women are experiencing abuse.
Right. Well, that's another good question. I don't think it's a myth, but I don't think mm-hmm. it just tells me that those support people haven't had enough training or experience supporting women, because those are women that have been rejected by systems, have been mistreated, have been harmed in their search for help. And so by the time when we do training, we do an exercise that where we ask professionals to go from place to place following a woman's story. And by the time they've hit the fifth or sixth station, they begin to understand how frustrating it is to be turned away, to be told there's wait lists, to be told it's not bad enough, to be told that she doesn't qualify, to be told to go home and wait for a call where she doesn't have a phone. And she's doing all this with two children and she's hungry because she doesn't have enough food. So by the time she gets to one station, yeah, sometimes a woman is really frustrated. And I think it's our job as service providers and support people to really see beyond that behavior and not just label it, oh, she's angry. We don't serve people who are angry.
Yeah. Is it possible when professionals see a couple and the abusive man can come across as sort of mild-mannered and quiet, and then the woman, because sort of she's in front of a professional, you know, being more aggressive perhaps or angry even, and so is that something that happens often?
It's certainly something that happens, and women describe that all the time, especially with couples counseling, which is not recommended, mm-hmm. where the man is being abusive to the woman, because of course she won't be able to tell her story without feeling that she'll be at risk later, or maybe not believed by the therapist, etc. So yes, so women in many circumstances, not just in front of a therapist, but in front of a police officer, mm-hmm. at the hospital, we would see these men who are charming and they look like they're cooperative and helpful. And, you know, we often say it's hard to decide or to determine where this is supportive behavior and where it's controlling behavior. But I think we just need to have a lens on our help that wonders whether it's caring or whether it's controlling. Mm-hmm. When we just assume that it's caring, we make a lot of mistakes and put women at risk. And so it's our job to spend time with women, to understand the relationship, to understand how it's impacted her. So it's not so much what he's done, but how it's impacted her is how we really can understand abuse and the impact that abusive men have on women. So yeah, I think it's a very good question. And again, not to blame anybody, people just haven't had the right kind of training. You know, mostly they've had training to support couples to stay together. But there's a very different dynamic when there's violence involved. Once there's abuse, everything he does is about power and control. So even in the honeymoon, when it looks like he's trying to be positive, it's actually for the purpose of controlling her in a different way. And that takes a very skilled therapist or support person to really understand that.
One time seeing a couple, and they didn't name themselves as being in an abusive relationship, but in the course of seeing them, you know, they would start to describe abuse. So by then, everybody saw the couple. And I remember the men would sit there and cry, actually. And so that softened her up, and she changed her mind.
Right.
So they ended the couple counseling pretty, you know, only the first session or something. Was that true emotion from his part? Because this is something that I think often women would see, right? That the men would be crying and mm-hmm. begging for them. Is that sort of authentic emotion coming from him?
That is a good question, and I honestly don't know how to answer that question. I think my experience tells me that it's authentic emotion, mm-hmm. but that it also has a manipulative component to it, where he is trying to manipulate the situation to have it go back to the way he wants it to be.
Yeah.
So I truly believe that abusive men are also hurting and need help, and that they authentically feel shame and remorse mm-hmm. about what they've done, but at the same time they have a very strong belief system
yes.
that they are entitled to the control in the relationship at any cost. These two ways of being are in conflict, where he may feel remorseful, wants to be in the relationship, can't imagine his life without her, and yet is unwilling to change the way he is, to become a respectful, supportive partner where he sees them both equally. Who am I to say whether it's authentic or not? But I think what we try to help women see is whether there's action attached to those emotions. So that does he take action to become a safe partner, to become a respectful partner, to, you know, not be threatening?
Yeah, like really his belief system needs to change, right? Because he could have authentic emotions at that moment, but yet the certain belief system, certain beliefs that he has can kick in pretty automatically as
right.
well.
Including when he has those authentic feelings, his belief is that women, that his wife or partner should forgive him because he's kind of entitled to that. So even when there's an emotion like that, women are quite afraid to say, you know, cry if you want, but I don't trust you. They're afraid to say that because they know it will increase her risk. And so she goes along with those feelings, probably quite reluctantly, but also hopefully. And that hope is the thing that really keeps women in the relationship and sometimes traps women in the relationship.
I read somewhere that, you know, men who are abusive and they've been sent to receive some kind of anger management courses. And I read somewhere that that's not really effective. Is that, what's your thoughts about that?
That is absolutely correct, because the problem isn't anger management. Again, if we think back to that cycle where there's a honeymoon and tension and explosion, men don't tend to explode in public places. They tend to explode or escalate their behaviors in private, which tells us, very simply tells us, that he has a lot of control over his behaviors, including his anger, that he doesn't, you know, he's not like taking down his boss and sometimes men do, they do express hostility and aggression in public as well, but they're unlikely to hit their partner in public or really lose it on an ongoing basis in public. So what we actually see and what men in our study have told us is that they actually have quite a lot of control over their anger, and they use it very strategically to frighten their partners and their children. But they also use a whole host of other tactics to maintain the control in the relationship, including crying and promising to change, as well as punching walls and threatening to take the children. So it can run the whole gamut of different tactics, but they're all intended to keep the control and the power in the relationship. And they do that by frightening women and keeping them kind of one step down from them.
Would you say all types of abuse are emotional?
I would say that there's an emotional abuse component to all types of abuse, yes.
Can you give us some examples? I think the physical abuse, I think that's kind of obvious. That's what people tend to think when they think of. Can you give us some examples of, say, for example, sexual abuse or social abuse,
sure.
Emotional abuse even?
Again, I think sexual abuse, we might think of a sexual assault in the context of a relationship, forcing sex on a woman. A number of years ago, I was in Northern BC doing a training, and a woman in her 80s came to me and said, nobody's ever told me that what was happening to me was abuse. My husband died a few years ago, but I was with him for 55 years, and he always had on his bedside table a picture of what he referred to as his first and only lover. For 50-some years, he made her feel like she was ugly and fat and undesirable and repulsive. And that's a different way of expressing sexual violence, not necessarily what we think about, but, you know, putting them down sexually, saying that, you know, calling them whores and many things worse than that. And then on the other hand, forcing sex without consent, using pornography, demanding sex either in payment or just because that's what he wants. So that's sexual. Using children is also another form of abuse, threatening to take the children or to harm or kill the children, not paying child support, trying to get a 50-50 split so that he doesn't have to pay any child support in the custody agreement, lying to the kids, making the kids take a stand against the woman, verbal abuse, yelling and screaming, using sarcasm, and saying, I was just joking, boy, you take things seriously. So women always feeling like they're one step behind and not getting it. Spiritual abuse, using scripture against women, or putting down women's beliefs about their faith, preventing children from her children having access to faith. And social abuse, we talk about isolation. Sometimes women isolate themselves because they just feel like they don't deserve friends, or their partners threaten to kill a friend if they see them, or family. Men often express jealousy, and by doing that, it just tells women, like, don't make eye contact with anyone, just walk down the street with your eyes down so that he doesn't think you're looking at anybody. You know, checking her cell phone for things, always calling her on her cell phone so she feels like she has to answer, so she has to have it with her all the time, which creates this high level of nervous fear all the time. And then, you know, of course, emotional abuse, like just putting women down all the time, putting them in a no-win situation. Again, a woman once described her husband very nicely took her to the psych unit and told them that she was hallucinating and hearing voices. And that woman later asked a friend to go to her home to pick up some of her belongings. Mm-hmm. And when the woman turned the light switch on, it turned on voices that he had piped in through the audio system. So he was actually creating this sense of craziness for a woman. So, you know, I don't know if we call that psychological or emotional abuse, but it was very, it landed a woman in a mental health unit because she thought she was actually hearing voices. So you can see by some of these examples that abusive men, not all men, but abusive men go to great lengths and use many strategies to keep women really terrified and walking on eggshells all the time and always feeling like they're the problem.
Sometimes a woman would say, well, but I'm also mean to him too. I've said pretty horrible things to him.
Right.
And they say I can be abusive to him too, or right. He would say she's pretty abusive to me. And so can you explain to us women's behaviors more in defense of themselves versus the woman being abusive?
Right. So just again to clarify for listeners, we work in the area of violence against women. So that's not to say that there aren't examples where women are the offender. But in the majority of cases across the globe, men are the perpetrators of violence against girls and women. And so that's my area of knowledge and experience. So having said that, I've never met a woman who doesn't say, I'm also abusive. What I'd like to help women think about are two things. One is, absolutely, can women behave badly in relationships? Yes. But is it abuse? Not when he's abusive. You can't have two abuses, because abuse is built on power and control. And his motives are to have power and control, whereas women's motives tend to be either, you know, at some point just feeling like I have to fight back to protect myself or to protect the children. So it can be in retaliation, or it can sometimes be even, women often say they kind of poke at their offender in the hopes of having the abuse happen so that they can get it over with. But generally speaking, his motive is for power and control, and her motive is for self-protection and preservation.
Yeah, no, thanks for explaining that, you know, because I remember hearing that from someone, right, distinguishing that difference. In your experience, Joe, I know that you mostly work with women, but what might be some differences between women who experience abuse versus men who experience abuse?
You're right, it's not my area of expertise. I think, generally speaking, the way we understand who the perpetrator is and who the person is experiencing abuse is by the impact. So for example, I'm going a roundabout way of answering this. When we did men's treatment programs for a number of years, we would ask men, you know, tell us about the relationship, and he would say, she's abusive. I look at this, she broke my finger, she scratched me down my back. And we would say, and so how has that affected you? And he would laugh it off, like, well, there's no effect. So in other words, he didn't experience any fear or control or oppression as a result of that. Whereas when we say to women, what's the impact? They have such a long list of ways that the abuse has impacted them. You know, they wonder if they're going crazy. They feel depressed. They're scared all the time. They develop eating disorders and substance use. It becomes a way of coping. They feel brainwashed and have panic attacks. And the lists that women provide for us when we ask what the impacts are often fill a whole wall of flip chart pages, whereas when we would ask men who are abusive what the impact was, they would laugh it off. And so I assume that for a man who's being abused, the list of impacts would be the same. So we don't point to the behavior of the offender to understand abuse. We look at how the offender's behavior has affected the woman or the man, your question, yeah.
So earlier you talked about the idea of leaving the relationship. Very difficult for women, many things to consider. Financially, emotionally, childcare or wise, all those things. What might be some other options for women?
Right. Before women leave, they make a decision, not whether they leave or not, but whether in process of making a decision, we really encourage them to find support, either through a women's shelter or a transition house, through victim services support, through a good counselor who understands violence against women. Certainly, I think our book, When Love Hurts, is a good resource for women just to, as a place to help them understand their experience differently and see the patterns and of his control and see how it's affecting her. And then just evaluate who's a good friend. Who can I call in an emergency? What family could I go and stay with? Maybe she lives in a small town and knows the RCMP, that she could go and talk to them about thinking about leaving. But certainly women's organizations, the YW, for example, often has a good resource. So our hope is that women get in touch with other women who've experienced the same thing and can maybe help them. And also just to do, you know, just look at, like, if I'm working, how do I tell my boss that I now have a restraining order and he's not allowed at work? So really go through all, do is my name on the rental agreement? Can I stay in the house or will I have to leave? Do we have a good and solid, is my name on everything that we own? Do I need to do anything legally? Do I have all my tax papers? You know, there's a lot. So often women leave a crisis and go to a transition house or women's shelter. But that's a crisis, and they often go back to the relationship because they haven't had a plan to leave. They've just had a plan to escape a very dangerous situation often. So preparing to leave is a different process, and we really encourage women to get a lot of support and identify who their support people might be, a doctor or another healthcare worker. Maybe they're involved with addiction services or mental health. But again, we encourage women to look at their records, make sure that their records are fair and reflective of her reality. Often those records don't help women later on. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done before women leave. As with any person leaving a relationship, it's not easy to disentangle from a relationship. And especially when you're feeling exhausted and under threat and your kids are under threat, it's a lot to ask women. So we encourage people to really support women while they work through that process to making a decision. And for some women, it's not ever the right decision. And that's a decision that only a woman can make for herself.
I'm wondering if one of the challenges is, you know, for the woman to consider that this is a problem that they're thinking leaving, but yet maybe they don't really want to leave, and they go to professionals. A lot of professionals have this bias that they must leave. And so they feel like professionals not really understanding their perspectives.
Right.
Is that a common thing?
It is a common thing. And so then what happens is that women have to conceal part of their reality, mm-hmm. Which is sometimes why women don't tell service providers, because they have a kind of naive or binary response, like either you stay or you leave. And, you know, often women can leave temporarily, and even if their partner is trying to change, like she still may decide to leave in the short term to get some evidence on whether she might be safe in the relationship. So yes, child protection services, the legal services, and I think helping professionals generally see this problem as if she stays, maybe it's not that bad, or maybe she deserves it. I mean, some very bad myths around staying, that she's not interested in protecting her children. And then leaving is oversimplified. So I really think that the most help we can be to women is to really appreciate how complex, how risky sometimes it is to make this decision, and how little there is out there to really help women to leave in a way that's safe, where they don't put their children in poverty, or where they don't really lose so much of their previous lifestyle. So it's a lot for women to consider. And we hope that women find good support where they can work their way through that in their own way and in their own time, and encourage professionals to think beyond the kind of oversimplified idea of staying and leaving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember, you know, supporting a woman, and she was in her 60s, but lots of emotional and sexual abuse. Like, he would go to another country to have an affair, and very yes. obvious, like, he would talk about how many times they had orgasms with her. Yes. So no intention of hiding, right? Because I guess she saw she was too old to leave, and she wouldn't have money and things like that. So it was I really had to consciously just support her choice. And I think what helped her was just being able to talk to someone.
Exactly.
And because she's been so isolated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's for something I think professionals need to, even just supporting them to get back to get out of that survival mode. Right. It's hard to make plans when you're in that survival mode. Yeah. So that's why I wanted to bring up that point about leaving, because they probably, when they come in, they probably don't think about leaving yet.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, that's not why they're coming. They're just trying to figure out what's happening in the relationship, what's wrong with her, what's wrong with the relationship. And so there's a lot of support and discussion and helping women. Like, what we always say is that women are very accurate about what's happened to them, mm-hmm. but they often pick up the dominant mythologies and discourses about what's wrong with them. So they come in saying, you know, I need to learn how to set boundaries. I've got a bipolar disorder or a personality disorder. And it often that's not true, but they've picked up on the dominant discourse that there's something wrong with women that we need to fix, rather than there's something happened to women that we need to support them in. And you're absolutely right. Our job is to help them reframe and really deeply understand what's happened to them, and help them see there's nothing wrong with them. And we're not in the right position to say staying and leaving is what work she should be doing. It's really about her choice, and our job is to help her along in that journey.
Is there any hope for those relationships? Is there anything that the woman can do or the men can do to help with the relationship? Because I read somewhere that it's a differential power, and that kind of relationship is really difficult to change.
Very difficult. And
yet I've also seen, you know, some relationships have changed as well. So is it because mm-hmm. the men get help, or is it the woman's change herself? What do you think about that?
Well, certainly women can change themselves a lot, and the abuse continues. In fact, sometimes her changes can be very threatening for their partner. So that's just a caution for women, is not to come home all excited about her new learning and share it with an abusive partner. It might be quite dangerous. But for men, it's a long journey to change. We're talking, as you said earlier, about belief systems. And to change your belief system from ideas about men being central, superior, and deserving, to asking men to step into a new world where they see everybody in the world as somebody who's an equal, that they have respect for, and that they really include in a very significant way, it is challenging for men, and more so to change, as you say, that power differential within the relationship. Often what we found is that supporting women and offering men treatment permits women to leave the relationship in a safer way, so men aren't continuing to use their abusive behaviors once women leave. So at the very least, women have a better sense of being able to leave with the children in a safe way. And occasionally men really make significant changes, enough for women to trust that they'll be safe. But it's hard for men to change that much. It's hard for any of us to change our beliefs. It would be like asking a woman to stop thinking about relationships as equal and respectful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, they're deeply entrenched ideas, and they're supported in our culture. So, and some professions really echo those ideas of central, superior, and deserving. And women often talk about partners who are doctors and lawyers and police officers in particular, mm-hmm. as professions that really are predicated on notions of hierarchy. And it's very hard for men who are enculturated that way to make changes, or to even see the reason to make changes. That invitation to invite change is often challenging. Women come in saying they're 50% responsible, and men come in usually saying they're not responsible. And in treatment, we try to take the responsibility away from women, because there's nothing that women can do that causes abuse. They're not responsible for the abuse. And on the other side, for men, it feels like a very long process of negotiating until they finally can accept that they are 100% responsible for using abuse in their relationships. And that's the reality, is that men are 100% responsible for their choice to use abuse in the relationship against their partner.
One of the big reasons often for to keep women in the relationship is children. They want the children to have a father. Can you tell us a bit about the impact of violence or abuse on children?
Well, certainly there is an impact on children. And again, it's one of those situations where women may feel like they're in a no-win situation. They feel like if they stay, perhaps child protection or family members feel like she's being an irresponsible mother because she's putting her children at risk, rather than saying, he's putting the children at risk. She is not. She's protecting the kids. And then leaving, then she sets in motion custody, where he has 50% of custody, and that's another way that she can't protect them. And so women really feel like they're in this no-win situation with the children. But in terms of research is showing that actually children being separated from their mothers shows more potential trauma and other harm than witnessing abuse. So in other words, when children are taken from their mothers because of the abuse, they actually show more negative impacts than staying in a relationship where they're witnessing the abuse, but with their mothers and being protected by their mothers. So that's not to say that children aren't affected. They are often affected in many ways, like the woman. They learn to be, they learn the cycle. They learn that if they go along with their dad, they may be safer. They learn that there are times that they just have to be quiet and go to their rooms and play or stay out of his way. And so they intuitively know that cycle as well, and they often have health, similar to women, health problems and anxiety and depression. So it does affect the whole family for sure, the women and the kids. And I think, again, our society's missed the mark that we really need to think of the women and children as the dyad, to be supported rather than separating kids from their mothers. Yeah, treating them as the new family.
You have some last words for women in abusive relationships before we end here today?
Yes. When Karen and I wrote the book the first time, we didn't have a final chapter because we hadn't worked with women for a long enough time frame to really know that there is hope for women, that women find joy and find contentment and peace and safety, and at the same time offer hope to other women. And I think that's one of the things that we try to offer in the book, is hope for women, because it may feel so overwhelming when a woman picks up the book or goes for help, but as she works her way through and gets support, she will see that she's okay and that her decisions with the right support and planning will get her to safety, whether it's staying or starting a life with her children on her own. Yes, of course there's hope for women. They've survived a lot and they've got a lot of strength and wisdom. And we really trust that women will, with the right support, make decisions that will, lead to better lives for them. And so we do see women rebuilding their lives and having new friendships with other women and maybe new relationships. And women talking about feeling more optimistic and thinking clearly, feeling rejuvenated and normal and feel safe or safer. So more confident, trusting themselves, trusting their own instincts and voice on issues. And yeah, there's hope.
Well, thank you very much, Jill. And that's been very informative. So thanks for your expertise.
Thank you so much for having me on your program. It's been a pleasure.
And that was a conversation with Jill Corey, co-author of the book, When Love Hurts, A Woman's Guide to Understanding Abuse in Their Relationships. And here is a TED Talk by a woman named Leslie Morgan Steiner. And she shared her personal story of surviving domestic violence.
I'm here today to talk about a disturbing question, which has an equally disturbing answer. My topic is the secrets of domestic violence. And the question I'm going to tackle is the one question everyone always asks. Why does she stay? Why would anyone stay with a man who beats her? I'm not a psychiatrist, a social worker, or an expert in domestic violence. I'm just one woman with a story to tell. I was 22. I had just graduated from Harvard College. I'd moved to New York City for my first job as a writer and editor at 17 Magazine. I had my first apartment, my first little green American Express card, and I had a very big secret. My secret was that I had this gun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head by the man who I thought was my soulmate many, many times. The man who I loved more than anybody on earth held a gun to my head and threatened to kill me more times than I can even remember. I'm here to tell you the story of crazy love, a psychological trap disguised as love, one that millions of women and even a few men fall into every year. It may even be your story. I don't look like a typical domestic violence survivor. I have a BA in English from Harvard College, an MBA in marketing from Wharton Business School. I spent most of my career working for Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Leo Burnett, and The Washington Post. I've been married for almost 20 years to my second husband, and we have three kids together. My dog is a black lab, and I drive a Honda Odyssey minivan. So my first message for you is that domestic violence happens to everyone. All races, all religions, all income and education levels. It's everywhere. And my second message is that everyone thinks domestic violence happens to women, that it's a women's issue. Not exactly. Over 85% of abusers are men. And domestic abuse happens only in intimate, interdependent, long-term relationships. In other words, in families. The last place we would want or expect to find violence, which is one reason domestic abuse is so confusing. I would have told you myself that I was the last person on earth who would stay with a man who beats me. But in fact, I was a very typical victim because of my age. I was 22. And in the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are three times as likely to be domestic violence victims as women of other ages. And over 500 women and girls this age are killed every year by abusive partners, boyfriends, and husbands in the United States. I was also a very typical victim because I knew nothing about domestic violence, its warning signs, or its patterns. I met Connor on a cold, rainy January night. He sat next to me on the New York City subway, and he started chatting me up. He told me two things. One was that he, too, had just graduated from an Ivy League school, and that he worked at a very impressive Wall Street bank. But what made the biggest impression on me that first meeting was that he was smart and funny, and he looked like a farm boy. He had these big cheeks, these big apple cheeks, and this wheat blonde hair, and he seemed so sweet. One of the smartest things Connor did from the very beginning was to create the illusion that I was the dominant partner in the relationship. He did this, especially at the beginning, by idolizing me. We started dating, and he loved everything about me, that I was smart, that I'd gone to Harvard, that I was passionate about helping teenage girls and my job. He wanted to know everything about my family and my childhood, my hopes and dreams. Connor believed in me as a writer and a woman in a way that no one else ever had. And he also created a magical atmosphere of trust between us by confessing his secret, which was that as a very young boy, starting at age 4, he had been savagely and repeatedly physically abused by his stepfather. And the abuse had gotten so bad that he had had to drop out of school in 8th grade, even though he was very smart. And he'd spent almost 20 years rebuilding his life, which is why that Ivy League degree and the Wall Street job and his bright, shiny future meant so much to him. If you had told me that this smart, funny, sensitive man who adored me would one day dictate whether or not I wore makeup, how short my skirts were, where I lived, what jobs I took, who my friends were, and where I spent Christmas, I would have laughed at you. Because there was not a hint of violence or control or anger in Connor at the beginning. I didn't know that the first stage in any domestic violence relationship is to seduce and charm the victim. I also didn't know that the second step is to isolate the victim. Now, Connor did not come home one day and announce, you know, hey, all this Romeo and Juliet stuff has been great, but I need to move into the next phase where I isolate you and I abuse you. So I need to get you out of this apartment where the neighbors can hear you scream and out of this city where you have friends and family and coworkers who can see the bruises. Instead, Connor came home one Friday evening and he told me that he had quit his job that day, his dream job. And he said that he had quit his job because of me, because I had made him feel so safe and loved that he didn't need to prove himself on Wall Street anymore. And he just wanted to get out of the city and away from his abusive, dysfunctional family and move to a tiny town in New England where he could start his life over with me by his side. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was leave New York and my dream job. But I thought you made sacrifices for your soulmate. So I agreed, and I quit my job, and Connor and I left Manhattan together. I had no idea I was falling into crazy love, that I was walking headfirst into a carefully laid physical, financial, and psychological trap. The next step in the domestic violence pattern is to introduce the threat of violence and see how she reacts. And here's where those guns come in. As soon as we moved to New England, you know that place where Connor was supposed to feel so safe? He bought 3 guns. He kept one in the glove compartment of our car. He kept one under the pillows on our bed. And the third one he kept in his pocket at all times. And he said that he needed those guns because of the trauma he'd experienced as a young boy. He needed them to feel protected. But those guns were really a message for me. And even though he hadn't raised a hand to me, my life was already in grave danger every minute of every day. Connor first physically attacked me 5 days before our wedding. It was 7 a.m. I still had on my nightgown. I was working on my computer trying to finish a freelance writing assignment, and I got frustrated. And Connor used my anger as an excuse to put both of his hands around my neck and to squeeze so tightly that I could not breathe or scream, and he used the chokehold to hit my head repeatedly against the wall. 5 days later, the 10 bruises on my neck had just faded, and I put on my mother's wedding dress, and I married him. Despite what had happened, I was sure we were going to live happily ever after, because I loved him, and he loved me so much. And he was very, very sorry. He had just been really stressed out by the wedding and by becoming a family with me. It was an isolated incident, and he was never going to hurt me again. It happened twice more on the honeymoon. The first time, I was driving to find a secret beach, and I got lost. And he punched me in the side of my head so hard that the other side of my head repeatedly hit the driver's side window. And then a few days later, driving home from our honeymoon, he got frustrated by traffic, and he threw a cold Big Mac in my face. Connor proceeded to beat me once or twice a week for the next 2.5 years of our marriage. I was mistaken in thinking that I was unique and alone in this situation. 1 in 3 American women experiences domestic violence or stalking at some point in her life. And the CDC reports that 15 million children are abused every year. 15 million. So actually, I was in very good company. Back to my question. Why did I stay? The answer is easy. I didn't know he was abusing me. Even though he held those loaded guns to my head, pushed me downstairs, threatened to kill our dog, pulled the key out of the car ignition as I drove down the highway, poured coffee grinds on my head as I dressed for a job interview, I never once thought of myself as a battered wife. Instead, I was a very strong woman in love with a deeply troubled man, and I was the only person on earth who could help Connor face his demons. The other question everybody asks is, why doesn't she just leave? Why didn't I walk out? I could have left any time. To me, this is the saddest and most painful question that people ask, because we victims know something you usually don't. It's incredibly dangerous to leave an abuser. Because the final step in the domestic violence pattern is kill her. Over 70% of domestic violence murders happen after the victim has ended the relationship, after she's gotten out, because then the abuser has nothing left to lose. Other outcomes include long-term stalking, even after the abuser remarries, denial of financial resources, and manipulation of the family court system to terrify the victim and her children, who are regularly forced by family court judges to spend unsupervised time with the man who beat their mother. And still we ask, why doesn't she just leave? I was able to leave because of one final sadistic beating that broke through my denial. I realized that the man who I loved so much was going to kill me if I let him. So I broke the silence. I told everyone. The police, my neighbors, my friends and family, total strangers. And I'm here today because you all helped me. We tend to stereotype victims as grisly headlines, self-destructive women, damaged goods. The question, why does she stay, is code for some people for it's her fault for staying. As if victims intentionally choose to fall in love with men intent upon destroying us. But since publishing Crazy Love, I have heard hundreds of stories from men and women who also got out, who learned an invaluable life lesson from what happened, and who rebuilt lives, joyous, happy lives, as employees, wives, and mothers, lives completely free of violence. Like me. Because it turns out that I'm actually a very typical domestic violence victim and a typical domestic violence survivor. I remarried a kind and gentle man. We have those three kids. I have that black lab, and I have that minivan. What I will never have again, ever, is a loaded gun held to my head by someone who says that he loves me. Now, right now, maybe you're thinking, wow, this is fascinating. Or wow, how stupid was she? But this whole time, I've actually been talking about you. I promise you, there are several people listening to me right now who are currently being abused, or who were abused as children, or who are abusers themselves. Abuse could be affecting your daughter, your sister, your best friend right now. I was able to end my own crazy love story by breaking the silence. I'm still breaking the silence today. It's my way of helping other victims. And it's my final request of you. Talk about what you heard here. Abuse thrives only in silence. You have the power to end domestic violence simply by shining a spotlight on it. We victims need everyone. We need every one of you to understand the secrets of domestic violence. Show abuse the light of day by talking about it with your children, your coworkers, your friends and family. Recast survivors as wonderful, lovable people with full futures. Recognize the early signs of violence and conscientiously intervene, de-escalate it, show victims a safe way out. Together, we can make our beds, our dinner tables, and our families the safe and peaceful oases they should be. Thank you.
This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour, hosted by Quinlay Erickson, every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time. For more information about Quinn, visit www.quinle.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and you have a beautiful, restful sleep. Good night.